in the first parts of chapter 6, Krishna has spoken of the necessity to work in a detached fashion. And if one is performing yoga, and actually this is true for all types of yoga, including bhakti yoga, that if one wants to advance, one has to renounce the desire for sense gratification. If one maintains material desires, it is like the story that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to tell of the marriage procession, how the boat was docked on the shore with its anchor down. The marriage party entered in at night. They told the boatmen to row and row and row, and next morning they would reach their destination. They went to sleep. The boatmen rowed and rowed and rowed and rowed. The sun rose, and they saw they were in exactly the same position. Because the boatman had not pulled up his anchor of the boat, so therefore all the work that was done was in vain. He was sincerely trying, but he did not renounce the desire for sense gratification like that. So sometimes we hold deep in our heart desires for sense gratification, and still we practice Krishna consciousness. And we use sometimes Krishna consciousness to gain our sense gratification. And we should know that we will not get the proper result from this. So a yogi must renounce the desire for sense gratification. And yet, he must continue working. There are two stages, yoga ruruksu and yoga ruda. The yoga ruruksu stage is the beginning stage, and one must still perform work in that stage in addition to his practice of yoga. Say, that is yam, niyam, means the rules and regulations, what you can do and what you can't do. Then after yam and niyam, after one is fixed in practicing the rules and regulations properly, and one is really fixed and detached, then one can practice asanas. And then after asanas, which we usually think of as what is yoga, but it is not yoga. The whole process is yoga. Asanas are just 1/8 of yoga. By this 1/8 of yoga, the asanas, one's body becomes very healthy, one's mind becomes very strong, one is able to control and balance the different airs within the body, and he gains minute control over his body. So it is really for someone in bodily consciousness. So he gains that in the third step. And in the fourth step, then only when he's healthy and his control over his body and mind, then he begins to practice pranayama, which means breathing or breath control. And because the breath is intimately connected with the mind, by practicing pranayama, and there are so many different kinds of pranayama, the mind, it comes under control. This is the purpose of pranayama. And then the next stage, the fifth stage, is pratyahara. When the mind comes under control, one can then withdraw it from the sense objects. Right now the mind is wild and is attached to the sense objects. But once one's mind comes under control, it can withdraw it. Then, after one's mind is withdrawn from the sense objects, then one can place it in the first stage of meditation of dharan on the supersoul, or on the self, and gradually transfer it to the supersoul through the next stages, more intense meditation in dhyan, and then finally complete absorption in samadhi. So this is the Ashtanga Yoga system. So in the beginning of the system, one cannot give up work for the same reason that Krishna recommends work in chapter 5 of the Bhagavad Gita. Because if one tries to practice these type of processes, and unless his heart is pure, he will fall victim to his impure heart and the sense gratification, because the senses will not be engaged if he does not work. So therefore, again, Krishna is recommending work. Then, this yoga rudha stage is described, and why one has to control the senses, because they will attach themselves to the mind, and then the mind will degrade one. This is what's being described. Now then what the yoga rudha stage is described, perfectional stage, or very advanced stage, where one can give up nishkam karma, is he's very neutral when it comes to the material world. And especially, he sees friends and enemies equally. Now in text 10, which will begin today, there is the beginning of the explanation of what one should do if one is on the yoga rudha stage, where one can begin practicing yoga. I mean, begin practicing in a secluded place the practices that will now be described. So here are the summary practice of the basis is in text 10. Yogi yunjita satatam. You must constantly concentrate his consciousness. Atmanam rahasi stita. His body, mind, and self must be concentrated in this way. Not one day concentrated and the next day not concentrated. Rahasi, in a secluded sacred place. Stita, he should situate himself. Ekaki yata chita atma. That means he should be alone. Ekaki means alone. He is not allowed to have his disciples with him. He cannot have anyone with him. He is in a secret, sacred place, and he is alone. And he's always careful. Yata chita atma, about controlling his mind. And nirashya means he is not attracted by anything else except self-realization. Aparigraha means free from the feelings of possessiveness. So he's free from all material desires and also the tendency towards possessiveness. Prabhupada translates this. This again is the basis of yoga practice. When one is on the yoga rudha platform, when one can give up work or nishkam karma. A transcendentalist should always engage his body, mind, and self in relationship with the Supreme. So he's so fixed in his spiritual desire. He should live alone in a secluded place. So Prabhupada explains in the purport, this ekaki, it shows that this yoga practices that are done in the cities where there are so many yoga societies are set up are completely useless if one wants to actually achieve the goal of yoga. Because ekaki, one must be alone. Because, like the story in the Bhagavatam of that girl who had so many bangles on, and she didn't want anyone to know that she was rolling for putties or something. So she ended up having to take off one bangle and only keep one bangle on one hand and one on the other. Why? Because as soon as there is two, the bangles will clink, 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 clink. And as soon as there's two people, they'll be...
Really? I didn't know that. Oh!
And so much time will be wasted in that way. And it will be so hard to control the mind and free, become free from material desires, and one naturally, when one can't be like this, one will get possessive also. So here are the basic principles of yoga practice, and actually, as we'll find out, that all the actual practices of yoga will automatically actually be done in Krishna consciousness, or the conclusions of yoga practice are actually concluded by Krishna consciousness. For instance, if a devotee is acting properly, he is fully renounced, but he doesn't have to live only alone to be renounced and have no material things. Rather, he has to see everything as belonging to Krishna, and then things can be used in Krishna's service. And Prabhupada quotes that in the purport, Anashaktasya Vishnani Tartanapanyakata. Nirbanda Krishna Sambande Yukta Vairagya Uchita. So here are the basic principles of yoga. One, that one should always engage his body, mind, and self in relationship with the Supreme. In other words, everything he does should be in relationship to the Supreme, either the Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagawan, depending upon what aspect of the Supreme that he is intending to achieve. But everything should be done. He should be fixed. Again, this is vyavya satmika buddhi ekeha kurunanda. And if one doesn't have this, he will be bahushaka, or many-branched, and he will get nowhere. He will just cause himself and others trouble. So the first thing, all his endeavors should be directly towards the Supreme. Secondly, he should carefully control his mind in this regard, and that basically means he should have no material desires, and he should have no feelings of possessiveness. He should not think anything is mine. Now how does he actually practice this yoga? This will be described in many verses that follow, but first, the place of practice is described. And how to sit will also be described, because these are the basic things. You have to sit down, begin your practice, you have to find the place, then you sit down. So to practice yoga, one should go to a secluded place and should lay kusha grass on the ground and then cover it with a deerskin and a soft cloth. So first kusha grass, then on top of that a deerskin, and then a cloth. Why a cloth? Because the cloth can be washed and it can be kept clean and in the mode of goodness. And why kush? Because kush is auspicious, it is holy. Some people even say that it has the property to make anything that is on it lighter. And why the deerskin? Because the deer skin will keep snakes away. Because you can imagine, you're sitting in the forest in a secluded place, there is no one within 10 or 20 miles, and you're sitting there staring at the tip of your nose, and you see going past, and your mind has to be completely controlled and free from fear. Easy or difficult? Ah, yes, it is difficult. But if you know that snakes will not go where there is deer skin, then you can relax and your mind can still be free from fear and you can practice yoga. So the deer skin is there so the yogi can be free from fear of snakes. Now the seat should be neither too high nor too low, because if it is too high, it will disturb the mind, or if it is not high enough, if it is too low, it will disturb the mind, and should be situated in a sacred place. Why a sacred place? Because sacred places have a holy influence. They push us in the direction towards the Supreme. If we sit in a contaminated place, something that is contaminated by the mode of ignorance or the mode of passion, those modes pull us down. But in a sacred place, the tendency is to be good, and therefore it will help one to sit in a sacred place. So then, the yogi should sit firmly on it and practice yoga to purify the heart. And he shouldn't be shaking back and forth when he is practicing. All that actually comes in the next verse in Achalam Stira. He shouldn't be moving back and forth like this when he's sitting. He has to sit very firmly and properly, and then he begins, once he's set up like that, he begins the real process of controlling his mind and his senses and all his activities and fixing the mind on one point. Because if the mind is fixed on one point, it will be very powerful in achieving the desired goal. And when one is sitting like that, he should sit on the asana. He should not stand on the asana. He should not sleep on the asana. These are all the rules for practicing yoga. He should not use the asana of others, nor should he let others use his asana. He should begin the practice of yoga by fixing the mind on one part, on one point. 13 and 14. One should hold, so here is what is one doing with one's body. One should hold one's body, neck and head erect in a straight line and stare steadily at the tip of the nose. Why stare steadily at the tip of the nose? Because if one keeps his eyes open, then he'll see so many things and he'll be distracted. He'll see tigers going by, he'll see beautiful parrots chirping in the green trees, he'll see fruits, he'll see wild boars running by. And he'll see so many different things. So he doesn't want to see those things, so therefore he shouldn't keep his eyes open, practically speaking. But we all know what happens if he closes his eyes. He'll be doing that type of meditation that we are all so familiar with, this one. He will fall asleep. So therefore, his eyes should be half open, practically, and staring at the tip of his nose, so he can't see anything except the tip of his nose, and that's not very exciting at all. It won't distract him, yet he'll stay awake. Thus, with an unagitated, subdued mind, devoid of fear, completely free from sex life, one should meditate upon me within the heart and make me the ultimate goal of life. So here Krishna is clearly saying what the ultimate goal of this yoga practice is. It is manasamyamya matchito yukta asita matpara, that concentrating the mind, or first subduing the mind and concentrating it on me, the actual yogi should make me, Krishna is saying, the ultimate goal. So Krishna, 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 Krishna is saying me. So Krishna himself is the ultimate goal of yoga. And this will actually be clear later. But in any stage of any yogi, karma yogi, jnana yogi, or Astanga yogi focuses on Krishna, he will achieve the supreme position. So these are the different practices of yoga. One has to be completely fearless to be successful. Why? Because how can one control, fix his mind on the supreme if he is full of fear? And actually, the nature of someone who's mind is fixed on the supreme is that he's fearless. And similarly, one has to be completely free from sex life. I recently read when some television interviewer asked Prabhupada why Is there no sex life outside of marriage in Krishna consciousness? He said, because unless one gives this up, one cannot have a peaceful mind to practice self-realization, because one will simply be trying to find new partners. This is the nature of the mind that is not fixed in Krishna consciousness. Just trying to find new partners. So therefore, in all these yoga practices, one cannot engage in any sex life. It's only in Krishna consciousness, in bhakti yoga, which is so powerful that it can actually minimize the attraction of the male-female relationship, is even married life actually possible for a practitioner? Actually speaking. Because bhakti yoga is so powerful that Krishna is so attractive that he can pierce the husband-wife relationship. And he's so powerful he can attract those souls to his lotus feet. But in any other type of yoga, one must immediately give up. There's no question of engaging in this relationship. So one should not, of course, devotees should not take advantage of the potency of Krishna consciousness. They should be brahmacharis even if married. That means that there is no combination except for the procreation of children. Otherwise, one will become fixed in the bodily concept of life. And if one is fixed in the bodily concept of life, because that is what sex life does, it fixes one in the bodily concept of life. It welds the senses and the mind to the body, and brings out one's lower nature. And in Krishna consciousness, or all types of yoga, one must subjugate the lower tendencies by the strength of Krishna consciousness. And if one doesn't do that, one will get himself in so much trouble, especially if he is in a holy place. One will, if one takes advantage of the strength of bhakti yoga and does not act properly in this regard in a holy place, especially in a holy place like Vrindavan, he will set himself back for thousands and thousands of births. So especially in Vrindavan, the devotees who are here should carefully guard, protect themselves, and make sure they do not fall into any improper activities in this regard. Otherwise, they will cause themselves unlimited trouble. I have seen it, actually. I've seen devotees make this mistake, and I see them pursued for years by this offense, the offenses they commit in this regard in Vrindavan. It's like, I've seen it happen. Even so-called big devotees that commit offenses in Vrindavan, and Krishna would not reveal it yet. And then they would think, oh, I'm getting away with it. I'm getting away with my illicit activities. Krishna is allowing it, or something like that. And then one day it happens that Krishna reveals it. And then, boom! I've seen it. They get smashed. And then they get up from being smashed. And then they think, well, at least it's over. And then I see again, boom! And I see the offense pursuing them. And pursuing them. So, we must be very careful. Not to pollute sacred places, especially this Sri Vrindavan Dham. And it's the place for the Goswamis, not Godas. Prabhupada said. So the result of practicing by controlling one's mind through the physical practices of yoga, completely free from sex life, and meditating upon Krishna within the heart, after for a long, long time after practicing, the result comes, and that is explained in 15. Thus practicing constant control of the body, mind, and activities, the mystic transcendentalist, his mind regulated, attains to the kingdom of God or the abode of Krishna by cessation of material existence. Prabhupada explains in the purport. The ultimate goal in practicing yoga is now clearly explained. Yoga practice is not meant for attaining any kind of material facility. It is to enable the cessation of all material existence. One who seeks an improvement in health or aspires after material perfection is no yogi according to Bhagavad Gita. Nor does cessation of material existence entail one's entering into the void, which is only a myth. There is no void anywhere within the creation of the Lord. Rather, the cessation of material existence enables one to enter into the spiritual sky, the abode of the Lord. So if one desires, has material desires, he will not become a yogi. He will not attain the result. If one desires subtle material power, the cities, he will not attain the proper result. So this practice, attaining shanti nirvana paramam, this practice of attaining transcendental peace with the cessation of material existence, as we have heard already and will hear again, it will come when one focuses his mind on the Supersoul. So more practices. There has to be a balance in eating, working, and sleeping. Natyashnatastu yogosti naichakanta mashnasnata nachati srapna silasya jagato naivacha arjuna. There is no possibility of one becoming a yogi or Arjuna if one eats too much or eats too little, sleeps too much, or does not sleep enough. One has to be exactly and perfectly balanced to succeed. The recommendations are there. When one eats, Prabhupada used to give this recommendation, and it is there in the commentaries as well, that one's belly should be half full of food, one quarter water, and one quarter air. If there's not enough food or too much water, this or that, if the balance isn't right, it will disturb the meditation. He who is regulated in his habits of eating, sleeping, recreation, and work can mitigate all material pains by practicing the yoga system. So up to this point, the practices of yoga, meditation, have been described, and now the perfection of yoga will be described. When the yogi, by practice of yoga, disciplines his mental activities and becomes situated in transcendence, devoid of all material desires, he is said to be well established in yoga. As a lamp, and here is an example to show how his mind is situated. He is devoid of all material desires, his mental activities are disciplined. So here is the example to explain what the mind of a perfected yogi is like. As a lamp in a windless place does not waver, so the transcendentalist whose mind is controlled remains always steady in his meditation on the transcendental self. So we should notice that transcendental self, it's not capitalized, the self, so that means he's fixed on his own self, which is also transcendental, which is mamayavangso jivaloke jivabhutasana. It is Krishna's angsa, or Krishna's part and parcel. It is spiritual. So he's focusing on his own self at this point. And this example is so nice, because if you take a candle and you put it in a windless place, it burns so cleanly and so steadily. And there is not even the slightest flickering of that candle if there is no wind. So similarly, just as that flame is steady, so similarly, the mind of this type of a yogi who is nearing perfection is non-flickering. It is simply fixed, steady in meditation on the self. And then on the other hand, when there is a slight breeze blowing, we see that candle flame will flicker every way. It will not be steady for a second. And this is what happens to someone whose mind is not controlled, whose practices are not proper, and who is agitated by material desires. He cannot focus his mind on the self. So this is samadhi. Now, how does that type of a yogi feel on this samadhi stage? The next 20 to 23 explain this. In the stage of perfection called trance or samadhi, one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. That means that he's fixed, his actual consciousness is fixed on the fact that he's a pure, effulgent spirit soul, that he will never die. And he's relishing his spiritual nature, the eternality of his self, the non-materialness of his self. So much, or practically 100% of our day is spent dwelling on material aspects of our false self. And our fears come from our situation in the material world, which is always changing. Just imagine if we actually saw with a concentrated mind and realized that we were eternal, that we were not this body, that we had nothing to gain in the material world. We have nothing to do with the material world. Imagine if we actually realized the spiritual nature of ourselves. How free from anxiety, fear, everything bad we would be. We would not be running after this and running after this material thing. We would not hurt others. We would be, what would we do? It would be so glorious. No fear, no anxiety. What could touch us? Who could hurt us? What to gain, what to lose in this material world? So such a yogi rejoices in the self because his pure mind is fixed in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth. And upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of the greatest difficulty. Because he knows those great difficulties have nothing to do with him. The difficulties only have to do with our material situation, place within the ocean of material disasters. A soul placed in the ocean of material disasters, identifying with every wave that rolls past. Something good happens. We identify, yes, now I have gotten something good. Now I am good. Now I am getting more powerful. Now I am getting more together. Now I know more. Now I become more expert. Now this horrible thing happens to me. Oh, I'm so unfortunate. But it's just the waves of material nature rolling over us. And we identify with every wave. So how unfortunate. So once one gets fixed in this transcendental position, one is never shaken even in the midst of greatest difficulties because he has no material identification. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. Just like the materialist is like a boxer. You know what is this boxer? He's fighting. Yes, like this. Should we demonstrate? No. So two boxers are fighting. And one goes like this, and the other one ducks. And he thinks, oh, how great it is. I've ducked. And he swings like that, and he goes, and he misses him. And he thinks, this is pleasure. And another punch, and he misses him. And he thinks, this is pleasure. Just, this is the attempt of the materialist, this dodging. We get a big boil over here on our head or on our nose, and then we remove it, we put this on it, we take this pill, and we put cucumbers on our nose, and beets, and potatoes. When I had that thing on my nose, everyone was telling me, I know just what you should do, you should put a potato on your nose. Anyway. Or beets, or cucumbers, things like this. So, and then when it goes away because you put a potato on your nose, you think, oh, how wonderful it is. That's just like dodging the punch of material nature. But it's just a matter of time before we get knocked out by material nature. It is only a matter of time. So whenever we dodge a punch or we gain a little pleasure, we think we're happy. But actually, we must get knocked out by material nature. So when one no longer identifies with being a body, when he understands his spiritual nature, then he's free from all miseries, which actually only arise out of material contact or material misidentification. So, one should engage oneself in the practice of yoga with determination. This is how this exalted stage is attained, and it's not attained quickly. One should engage in the practice of yoga with determination because we're not going to get success quickly. So one has to have great faith and great determination and not be deviated from the path. One should abandon, without exception, all material desires born of mental speculation and thus control all the senses on all sides by the mind. So the end of yoga, that fixedness on the self was described. Now how to attain it, and this is also true for bhakti yoga. One must surrender in this way. One must have full faith. Sharanagati, one must surrender with full faith. Vishva. Gotripte Vishvaso. So, Prabhupada explains in the purport the determination that is needed to practice. And for this determination, one must have faith. As for determination, one should follow the example of the sparrow who lost her eggs in the waves of the ocean. A sparrow laid her eggs on the shore of the ocean, but the big ocean carried away the eggs on its waves. The sparrow became very upset and asked the ocean to return her eggs. The ocean did not even consider her appeal. So the sparrow decided to dry up the ocean. So the sparrow was thinking, it may take me many, many births, but I'm going to do this. This ocean must give back my eggs. I don't care how long it takes, I shall do it. The sparrow took some kusha grass and a tiny beak and went down to the ocean. Started drying it up. I don't care how. So the sparrow was situated in knowledge. The sparrow understood she was not her body.
course, she was thinking that even if it takes many, many births, I shall succeed in drying up the ocean. She began to peck out the water in her small beak. And everyone laughed at her for her impossible determination. The news of her activity spread. And at last, Garuda, the gigantic bird carrier of Lord Vishnu, heard it. He became compassionate towards his small sister bird. So he came to see the sparrow. Garuda was very pleased by the determination of the small sparrow, and he promised to help. Thus Garuda at once asked the ocean to return her eggs, lest he himself take up the work of the sparrow. Garuda told the ocean that, "My dear ocean, if you don't give her back her eggs, I'm going to flap my wings and dry you up." And the ocean took that very, very seriously, knowing the power of Garuda. The ocean was frightened at this and returned the eggs. Thus the sparrow became happy by the grace of Garuda. Similarly, the practice of yoga, especially bhakti yoga and Krishna consciousness, may appear to be a very difficult job. But if anyone follows the principles with great determination, the Lord will surely help, for God helps those who help themselves. So we must do our work. It is not that we can do anything, but we can make the endeavor. And then Krishna will help us, just as Garuda helped his small sister bird. So one needs fixed faith to do this, because unless one has faith in the process, then how will one be so determined to proceed like this? So fixed faith is needed to be successful, and it is not expected that one will be successful in one day. So therefore, the next verse, Shanai Shanai Uparame Buddhya Dritti Grihitaya Atma Samstam Mana Kritra Nakinchidapi Chintaye. Shanai Shanai means gradually, gradually, step by step. This is the process of Krishna consciousness. But we don't go backwards. This is the vow. When we've given up horrible material activities, we don't go back to them. Even though our going forward may be slow, but as long as we don't go backwards, if we slowly go forward, we will get there. This is the determination of a devotee who's going to make advancement. So gradually, step by step, shanai shanai uparamid, one should become situated in trance by means of intelligence, sustained by full conviction, by full faith, and thus the mind should be fixed on the self alone and should think of nothing else. So one should simply fix his mind on his spiritual nature. One should fix his mind on his self, not on all the thoughts that he has. I want to do this, I don't want to do that, only if I had this, if I had this one more thing, I'd be happy and peaceful, and then I'd be able to study properly. No, we should not follow the thoughts as they come to the mind. We should not take them seriously. And what to do, that is explained in the next verse. Yato yato nischalati manas chanchanam astiram Tatas tatoniam ye tas atmini eva vashamayat. Wherever, and this nischalati means always agitated. Mana, the mind, chanchalam, flickering. Astiram, unsteady. So wherever this mind wanders due to its flickering, unsteady, agitated nature, the nature of the mind is this. It is the lamp in a windy place. So whatever, wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, one must certainly withdraw it and bring it back under the control of the self. In other words, one should not indulge the mind when the mind is flickering. The tendency is to want to feed it, indulge it with what it wants to make it peaceful. But it will not become peaceful. It will just grow more and more agitated. Don't indulge the mind. Bring it back under the control of the self. So now,
more the increasing towards perfection. He's focused his mind on himself. The yogi whose mind is fixed on me verily attains the highest perfection of transcendental happiness. He is beyond the modes of passion. He realizes his qualitative identity with the Supreme, and thus he is freed from all reactions to past deeds. Now, in the next verse, it describes this liberation, actually, in this verse and in this verse. Thus the self-controlled yogi, constantly engaged in yoga practice, becomes free from all material contamination and achieves the highest stage of perfect happiness and transcendental loving service to the Lord. So there's a difference again. Just as we heard in practicing Nishkam Karma Yoga, that one first understands that he is a soul, not his body, and then, because that is the knowledge given in the mode of goodness, that does not bring liberation. But then when he focuses his mind on the super soul, then he gets liberated. So it's the same thing here. One actually becomes liberated when he focuses his mind on the super soul. This super soul realization is the goal over here. A true yogi, and this, like directly after we heard in the last in chapter 5, directly after it described the super soul realization, directly after that it described the symptoms, the vision of someone who has that super soul realization. The next verse, 29, describes that vision, that equal vision of the one who has super soul realization. A true yogi observes me in all beings, and also sees every being in me. Indeed, the self-realized person sees me, the same Supreme Lord, everywhere. So he sees that all beings have the super soul within. And not only that, he sees that all beings exist within the super soul. So the super soul is within everyone, and everyone is within the super soul. This is the liberated person's vision. And then, very important verse. Yomam pashyati sarvatra savam chamai pashyati tasyaham na pranashyami sachamena pranashyati. For one who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, I am never lost, nor is he ever lost to me. So this is the benefit or the result of the previous vision of seeing Krishna everywhere. He is always with Krishna. He never falls down because he sees the Lord, the super soul, everywhere. So a person who is a jnani sees Brahma everywhere, sees the all-pervading Brahma platform, and the super soul realized person, he sees how everything is spirit, Brahman. He sees that it is Brahman through the super soul. Through the super soul, Krishna is pervaded everywhere. Purport. A person in Krishna consciousness certainly sees Lord Krishna everywhere. And he sees everything in Krishna. Such a person may appear to see all separate manifestations of the material nature, but in each and every instance, he is conscious of Krishna, knowing that everything is a manifestation of Krishna's energy. Stavaram jagamam deki na deki taramoti. Savatra hoya nija ishta deva sporti. That, this is from Chaitanya Charitamrita, that everywhere a devotee looks, he sees, doesn't exactly see moving and non-moving things. He sees Ishtadeva Spurti, the manifestation of his worshipable deity. That is the vision. Premanjana Chorita Bhakti Valochanena Shanta Shadaiva Hridayeshu Valokayanti. Nothing can exist without Krishna. Krishna is the Lord of everything. This is the basic principle of Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is the development of love of Krishna, a position transcendental even to material liberation. At this stage of Krishna consciousness, beyond self-realization, The devotee becomes one with Krishna in the sense that Krishna becomes everything for the devotee, and the devotee becomes full in loving Krishna. An intimate relationship between the Lord and the devotee then exists. How sweet. The example is sometimes given. If there are so many shoes outside, if we don't know the owners, we don't see anything but shoes, impersonal. But if the mother is walking outside and in 200 shoes, that's 100 pairs of shoes, she sees her 5-year-old son's shoes, then her heart melts and she feels great love and affection. So to another person, may see those same shoes and he just sees shoes. So when one has a relationship, a loving relationship with Krishna, he doesn't see anything impersonal. He just simply sees everything connected with his beloved Krishna. And he is full in Krishna consciousness all the time. Now, the next verse, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains, I'll read the verse first. Such a yogi who engages in the worshipable service of the Supersoul, knowing I and the Supersoul are one, remains always in me in all circumstances. A yogi who is practicing meditation on the Supersoul sees with himself the plenary portion of Krishna as Vishnu with four hands holding kansha, wheel, club, and lotus flower. The yogi should know that Vishnu is not different from Krishna. That is the meaning of the Sanskrit word ekatvam. So this is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains it here, and Prabhupada explains it here, even by seeing the Supersoul, one can understand that the Supersoul is a manifestation of Krishna. Ekatvam. So one can see Krishna everywhere, even when one is seeing the Supersoul. The yogi should know that Vishnu is not different from Krishna. Krishna, in this form of the Supersoul, is situated in everyone's heart. So it is Krishna situated as the Supersoul. There is once the gopis, Krishna had disappeared from the rasa dance, and the gopis were in Sevakund looking for Krishna. Where is Krishna? Krishna, where is Krishna? So Krishna, tricky as he is, he took on the form of Lord Narayan. A forearm form. And the gopis came. And they said, where is Krishna, O Lord Narayan? Because he's the worshipful deity of so many great sages and yogis and pure devotees. All of them saw him. And they said, O Lord Narayan, where is Krishna? Have you seen Krishna? And of course it was actually Krishna. And he said, nope, I haven't seen him. Oh, he went this way. He pointed his forearm sticking. But anyway, and then when Radharani, Srimati Radharani came, before her intense love for Krishna, the other two arms faded. He could not remain hidden. So the Supersoul is actually, and Narayan, Lord Narayan, is the manifestation of Krishna. Okay, and the last verse we'll read today. He is a perfect yogi who by comparison to his own self sees the true equality of all beings and both their happiness and their distress. So the activities of a yogi should equal his equal vision. So this has been previously explained, that he should act for the welfare of all. He, knowing the distress of others, should never put another into distress. And he, knowing the distress of others, should try to help everyone become free from distress. So therefore the yogi, the true yogi, he acts and does welfare for all. And of course, Prabhupada explains in the purport In other words, the devotee of the Lord always looks to the welfare of all living entities, and in this way, he is factually the friend of everyone. He is the best yogi because he does not desire perfection in yoga for his personal benefit, but tries for others also. So the process of Krishna consciousness is so wonderful because, and especially in ISKCON, Prabhupada has centered all the activities around preaching because we must be active. This point has been stressed hundreds of times practically. We must be active. So how should we be active so that we don't accrue in bad karma and or good karma even and entangle ourselves in the material world? So there are unlimited things that we can do in the preaching mission. But we must do it, do all of them, any of them, selflessly, on the order of Guru and Gauranga and Krishna. And we must act like a servant in that way. And we have to remove our selfish concept of self from the center of our activities. We should transfer that mood to being a servant. We have to stop discriminating and deciding what we're going to do based on what will bring us pleasure and what is good for me. We have to become servants, otherwise there is no advancement. We have to surrender. Not have to in the sense that we have no alternative, but if we wish to make advancement, we have to surrender. We may not be able to find anyone who we think is glorious enough for us to surrender to. But we are just losing out. Because we cannot remove our self from the central point in our life unless we surrender. Otherwise, all our discriminations, even though they may look like Krishna consciousness, they will be covered selfishness. We have to come to the point of surrender. Any questions? I'm sorry for going so fast, but this is a short week, so this is a long chapter, and we will probably end up finishing it in 3 days. The verses for this chapter.
In the last line of chapter 23, it says, "This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact." So are there other miseries than those arising from material contact? Or why is it stressed like sin from material contact?
If you put which arise from material contact, see, the miseries arise from material contact, which all arise from material contact. Freedom from all miseries which arise from material contact. All miseries arise from material contact.
Is this just a figure of speech?
Not a figure of speech, it's just...
But why would the Krishna use, he's using unnecessary words, because he could just...
What unnecessary
words? He could just have said freedom from all miseries.
But he's telling you he's also giving me an opportunity to preach from where miseries come from material contact. So he's put that in out of his mercy to me.
It's
dukkha samyoga. Samyoga means the contact. Just to let us know where miseries come from, and the focusing ourself being spirit, a spirit soul, removes ourselves from material contact. Last question.
The person who realizes himself, he experiences boundless happiness, experiencing pure, this text 22 and 23. Then he moves on in progressing to meditating on me.
Must ultimately end up meditating on Krishna. Otherwise one cannot get liberation.
What is his interest if he is already happy? Why is he progressing? Or what is the...
He wants to become more than boundlessly happy. And also
association. Without association, there is no of one who is placed higher. There is no impetus.
And the situation is in the field. Yes.
Shastra. Or he's in the field, but in the next field there's someone else.
But it seems a little bit like a regression from 23. This is like almost a perfect state, and in these other verses, they are like less
which
advanced.
Verse?
Like then the next.
Which verse?
Like if you have the text 23, there's the perfect stage described, and then in text 24, then Krishna he says. That one should engage oneself in practice. I mean, he's already situated in
his mind. But in 24, he's talking about the connection is that one can't. 24 and 25 is how to attain this stage that was just described.
Uh-huh. Okay. So it's not like a progression from that stage.
No.
It doesn't do magic.
Progression is kind of goes into the secret song.
But that comes a little later.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually in 28, 29, 30. Okay. So late. Go ahead.
Yeah.